Hi, Dave Emery here, side two, for the record, program number 758, The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, part four, Dramatis Personae, part four, Deep Fifth Column. This program has been recorded on 10/13/2013. This program is also something of a transition to the other shows we're going to do about the adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden. This is a very complicated, multi-layered analysis, hence my discussion of the elements involved here. Before I actually get to some of what I believe to be the goals of this underground Reich psyop, we have been speaking about the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which is the fountain of intellectual and economic thinking for the Austrian school, for Ron and Rand Paul, and for Eddie Snowden and WikiLeaks and their milieu. What I called in For the Record 756, the Palestinian Libertarian Organization. And both Peter Thiel, the number one financial backer of Ron Paul, and also the principal stockholder in Palantir, which is the largest stockholder in Palantir, which underwrites the largest investor, I should say, in Palantir, which developed the Prism software. They are explicitly, that is to say, the Ludwig von Mises Institute and Peter Thiel, explicitly reject democracy. And as the Bill Moyers op-ed piece from Talking Points memo of October 8th indicated, what we are seeing in Washington with Rand Paul and the Tea Partiers and the Palestinian Libertarian Organization, as I call it, at the very epicenter of what is going down, we are not only witnessing a fundamental rejection of democratic process, but basically a form of political secession. And the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the Palestinian milieu are inextricably linked with the neo-Confederate movement and those who seek to break up the United States. Now, we have been discussing the speech that Adolf Hitler gave to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf in 1932. That speech was what won the bulk of the German plutocrats and corporate Germany over to the Nazi Party. There were a number of reactionary parties in Germany, such as the Stahlhelm or Steel Helmet, that in many of the conservatives preferred. But it was Hitler's speech to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf that won over the top German industrialists and financiers to the Nazi Party and the Nazi point of view. By the way, Hitler's introduction to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf was made by none other than Fritz Thyssen, one of Hitler's earliest prominent financial backers and a business partner with George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the grandfather and great-grandfather of George Walker Bush and the grandfather and father of George Herbert Walker Bush and also the namesake for both George's Bush. George Herbert Walker was a business partner with Fritz Thyssen. We're now going to go back 20 years in time to May 30th of 1993. This is an addendum that I gave to the original Miscellaneous Archive show M11, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded on May 23rd of 1980. This, however, is on May 30th of 1993, and we're going to listen to discussion of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf.
Now, it was Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf that persuaded many of the top industrialists and financiers of Germany to back Hitler and the German Nazi Party, as opposed to some of the other conservative political parties that were in Germany at the time. This speech, the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, is, as I've said, it is not only very significant in terms of the evolution of German Nazism itself and the evolution of Adolf Hitler's political fortunes, it also has a larger significance, and I think it has a terrifyingly relevant perspective for those of us in 1993. It should be remembered that there are many in the corporate world, of course not all, I'm not even saying most, but many in the corporate world who will view the attitudes of Adolf Hitler with great favor and consequently will view democracy with disdain, fear, and contempt. For our discussion of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, we are going to turn to a book which I used in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast way back on May 23rd, 1980. This book is called Who Financed Hitler? Subtitled The Secret Funding of Hitler's Rise to Power, 1919 and 1933. It's authored by James Poole and Suzanne Poole, P-O-O-L. This book was published in both hardcover and softcover by the Dial Press and copyrighted 1979. Now again, the central feature of the pitch that Adolf Hitler gave before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, and it was a very successful pitch as well. It, as I said, it won over much of the industrial and financial elite of Germany, much of the corporate elite of Germany, over to the Nazi Party. Hitler's pitch was that democracy itself is inherently subversive. As I said, the underlying premise was almost quasi-Calvinist or perhaps social Darwinist. It was Hitler's contention that what he called the politics of personality, the authority of personality, should be dominant rather than the democratic process. Again, he told the assembled industrialists and financiers that they were superior. They enjoyed their superior position in society because they had superior abilities, and that their superior position was a direct manifestation of their inherent superiority. And he maintained that democracy itself, disdained by some as the mob beast, that democracy itself was subversive because it allowed inferior people to wield political power and for their own benefit, and that this would lead to a degeneration of society. Beyond that, Hitler went on to make a very explicit connection. He equated democracy with communism, and that is a viewpoint that unfortunately many of the world's industrialists and financiers, many of the world's corporate interests to this day maintain, and unfortunately that has been reflected in much of American foreign policy as it has been manifested since the end of the Second World War. The individual who brought Adolf Hitler to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf was an individual who you heard described earlier in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast. That's a fellow named Fritz Thyssen, capital T-H-Y-S-S-E-N, a German steelmaker. We discussed Thyssen not only in the original Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast from May of 1980, but also in one of the addenda from June 14th of 1992. And it was Fritz Thyssen who brought Adolf Hitler to the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now, the Poole's discussion of Hitler's speech here, to a large extent, speaks for itself, but bear in mind that the basic premise was a sort of quasi-Calvinist or social Darwinist view, which maintained that the industrialists and financiers, and bear in mind that in the Industry Club of Dusseldorf there were 600 of the most prominent of the German industrial and financial elite present, the contention of Hitler's was that they were inherently superior and that is why they enjoyed their superior position in society, because they had superior abilities and those superior abilities manifested themselves in their superior position. He then said that democracy was bad because it allowed inferior people to wield power, and that ultimately those inferior people would restructure society for their own benefit, and that this would be counter-evolutionary. It would lead to a degeneration of society. Beyond that, Hitler goes on to equate democracy with communism directly, and again, that's a viewpoint which is shared by a terrifyingly large section of the corporate elite, not only in this country, but of the world as a whole. I'm not maintaining that all of them feel that way, not even necessarily most, although one could argue perhaps that in terms of the ultimate manifestation of multinational corporate capitalism, it has worked out that way, but I will not make that contention. But we should note, as I have tried to point out in the past, that fascism is not something foreign to the United States, that many of the most prominent industrial and financial people, many of the most prominent elements of corporate society were openly pro-fascist and pro-Hitler in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and that they, to a large extent, have maintained that stance since in terms of the way they have governed not only the United States, but also much of the Third World as well. So Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf, again, is not only significant because of its place in the historical rise of Hitler, its place in the history of the rise of German fascism, it has a larger historical and political and sociological significance as well, one which bears great significance for those of us here in the United States in May of 1993. The Pools write of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now, bear in mind, this is 1931 when we're talking here. This is this might actually be the very beginning of 1932. I have always said that this was 1931. I may actually be wrong. I guess this was January 27th of 1932. So upon reading, I've always said this was 31. Actually, it was the very first month of 1932. So I will correct that error on the spot. Anyway, of Hitler's speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf in January, specifically January 27th of 1932, the Pools write as follows. Now again, Thiessen is Baron Fritz Thiessen, a key German steel magnate. A few days later, Thiessen was in Berlin, where he claimed he met Hitler by accident. He mentioned the upcoming speech at the Industry Club, and Hitler replied, quote, "I think it would be better if I came myself," unquote. Thus, an announcement was sent to all the members that Herr Adolf Hitler would be the guest speaker of the Dusseldorf Industry Club. At 7 o'clock on the evening of January 27th, over 600 members of the Industry Club assembled in a large ballroom at the Park Hotel in Dusseldorf to hear Hitler's speech. The attendance was much larger than usual. It was the first opportunity many of the industrialists had had for getting a close view in their own familiar surroundings of a man about whom they had heard so much. These busy businessmen were not the type to run around to turbulent mass meetings. However, to attend an address organized by the club might prove to be both stimulating and interesting. The majority of those present were supporters of Gustav Stresemann's German People's Party, which was known for its pro-business attitude, or one of the other moderate, quote, bourgeois, unquote, parties. There were some with more reactionary opinions who were members of the German Nationalist Party, but with the exception of Fritz Thiessen and possibly a few others, there were no avowed National Socialists among the group. Quote, "The room was overcrowded," unquote, said Otto Dietrich in his description of the scene. Dietrich is Dietrich. Resuming the text, by the way, Gustav Stresemann, Gustav, of course, Gustav, Stresemann, Stresemann. Beginning again this last paragraph, "The room," quote, "the room was overcrowded," said Otto Dietrich in his description of the scene. Again quoting, "Huddled together sat the chief West German magnates, men in the public eye and those quiet but no less influential powers who, moving behind the scenes, control the fate of the economy by the soft sounds issuing from their private offices. Men said to bear a ledger rather than a heart. Joyful expectation brightened the faces of those already converted, but the vast majority bore an air of superiority and cool reserve, probably flattered that Hitler had approached them. Mere curiosity and general interest lured them to the meeting. They wanted to hear Hitler speak. They had no intention of being converted. They came to criticize, seeking confirmation of their own infallible opinion. The audience was surprised and even a bit affronted when at Hitler's approach they heard bullying voices in the entrance hall shouting, quote, "Alles aufstehen," everybody up. Some flabbergasted actually rose. Others made a gesture of rising in unwilling conformity and some remained seated. Hitler strode to the rostrum amid strong silence, followed by Fritz Thiessen, the chairman of the evening, and a score of SA men in their brown shirt uniforms who took a position behind their Führer as a sort of stage backdrop. Hitler was wearing a rather ill-fitting cutaway coat and striped trousers, an attire in which he never looked quite comfortable. After a brief introduction by Fritz Thiessen, he received, quote, chilly, unquote, applause from the tightly packed audience. He was scheduled to speak for an hour and had requested that there be no smoking. Standing on a slightly raised platform, Hitler looked out at his audience and rested his hands lightly on an ornamental railing. The audience feared communism more than anything else. Realizing this, Hitler made the danger of Marxism the central theme of his speech. He discussed the topic with rational logic and made some startlingly accurate predictions about its future development. He said it was no use dismissing communism as a mere delusion of misguided manual workers. I'm going to read this last paragraph again because it's a critical one. The audience feared communism more than anything else. Realizing this, Hitler made the danger of Marxism the central theme of his speech. He discussed the topic with rational logic and made some startlingly accurate predictions about its future development. He said it was no use dismissing communism as a mere delusion of misguided manual workers. Quote, by the way, we should bear in mind before I continue that this book is being written in 1979. Of course, communism to a large extent is a thing of the past in 1993. Bolshevism, again quoting Hitler here, Bolshevism today is not merely a mob storming about in some of our streets in Germany, but it is a conception of the world which is in the act of subjecting to itself the entire Asiatic continent, and which today, in the form of a state, Russia, stretches almost from our eastern frontier to Vladivostok, reminiscent in some ways of the Evil Empire speech of Ronald Reagan. Continuing with Hitler's observations, the situation is represented as if here it was merely a question of purely theoretical problems, of views held by a few visionaries or evil-disposed individuals. No. A philosophy of life has won over to itself a state, and starting from this state, it will gradually shatter the whole world and bring it down in ruins. Bolshevism, if its advance is not interrupted, will transform the world as completely as in times past did Christianity. It is not as if this gigantic phenomenon could simply be thought away from the modern world. Unquote. Hitler argued, and this next paragraph is very important, the interpolative discussion by the Poles. Hitler argued that liberal democracy and the idea of human equality would inevitably lead to communism. Once again, Hitler argued that liberal democracy and the idea of human equality would inevitably lead to communism. Quote, you maintain, gentlemen, that German business life must be constructed on a basis of private property. Now, such a conception as that of private property can only be defended if in some way or another it appears to have a logical foundation. This conception must deduce its ethical justification from an insight into the necessity which nature dictates. By the way, nature has a capital N here. It cannot simply be upheld by saying, quote, it has always been so, and therefore it must continue to be so, unquote. For in periods of great upheaval, institutions and systems cannot remain untouched just because they have previously been preserved without change. It is the characteristic feature of all really great revolutionary epochs in the history of mankind that they pay astonishingly little regard for forms which are hallowed only by age. It is thus necessary to give sound foundations to traditional forms which are to be preserved so that they can be regarded as absolutely essential, as logical and right. Then I am bound to say that private property can be morally and ethically justified only if I admit that men's achievements are different. Only on that basis can I assert, since men's achievements are different, the results of those achievements are also different. And if the results of those achievements are different, then it is reasonable to leave to men the administration of those results to a corresponding degree. I'm going to read these last couple of sentences again, because they're critical. Again, we're quoting Hitler here. Then I am bound to say that private property can be morally and ethically justified only if I admit that men's achievements are different. Only on that basis can I assert, since men's achievements are different, the results of those achievements are also different. And if the results of those achievements are different, then it is reasonable to leave to men the administration of those results to a corresponding degree. It would not be logical to entrust the administration of the result of an achievement which was bound up with a personality either to the next best but less capable person or to a community which, through the mere fact that it had not performed the achievement, has proved that it is not capable of administering the result of that achievement. Last couple of sentences again, or this last sentence again. It would not be logical to entrust the administration of the result of an achievement which was bound up with a personality either to the next best but less capable person or to a community which, through the mere fact that it had not performed the achievement, has proved that it is not capable of administering the result of that achievement. Continuing with Hitler's speech, thus, it must be admitted that in the economic sphere, men are not of equal value or of equal importance. And once this is admitted, it is madness to say, in the economic sphere, there are undoubtedly differences in value, but that is not true in the political sphere. It is absurd to build up economic life on the conceptions of achievement, of the value of personality, and therefore in practice on the authority of personality, but in the political sphere to deny the authority of personality and to thrust into its place the law of the greater number, democracy. Once again, last couple of sentences. And once this is admitted, it is madness to say in the economic sphere there are undoubtedly differences in value, but that is not true in the political sphere. It is absurd to build up economic life on the conceptions of achievement, of the value of personality, and therefore in practice on the authority of personality, but in the political sphere to deny the authority of personality and to thrust into its place the law of the greater number, democracy, unquote. Then the Pools go on to say, this statement illustrates one of Hitler's most effective arguments. It relates directly to the personal interest of the audience. By a strong logical development based on fallacious premises, Hitler was leading to the inescapable conclusion that the concept of private property would gradually be destroyed by democracy, because democracy has as its ethical justification, its inner logic, the idea of human equality. If democracy continued to develop, it would gradually submerge the idea of private property, which was founded on a very different moral and ethical basis, the idea of individual differences and rewards allotted to talent. Interrupting here, the Pools ruminations, these arguments are terrifyingly close to many arguments one will hear on the political right in the United States today.
That again from May 30th of 1993, 20 years ago, about the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. Now compare that with the thinking of Hans Hermann Hoppe, turning once again to Down East Den. That is a blogger who posts on the Daily Kos blog. This from June 15th, 2010. Anarcho-fascism, the libertarian endgame. And we're going to listen to the philosophy of Hans Hermann Hoppe, a student of Jürgen Habermas, the same fellow who mentored Alex Karp of Palantir and Robotics. While looking into the world of Rand and Ron Paul and their supporters, I came across one of the guiding lights of the libertarian movement, Professor Hans Hermann Hoppe. Hoppe is a leading advocate of a libertarian philosophy which can only be described as anarcho-fascism. On his website, Hoppe states that he earned his Ph.D. philosophy in 1974 and his habitations, sociology and economics, 1981, both from the Goethe Universitat Frankfurt am Main. His thesis advisor was Jürgen Habermas, the great philosopher of discursive democracy. Somewhere along the way, Hoppe became disenchanted with pluralistic democracy, but he emigrated to the epicenter of modern democracy, America, and managed to get a tenured teaching position at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. While for Habermas, reason is the foundation of modern democratic society, for Hoppe, private property is the foundation of natural law, unquote, and he founded the Prosperity and Freedom Society, which is devoted to the cult of private property. But most of Hoppe's ideas on the evils of democracy can be found in his book, Democracy, the God That Failed, large chunks of which can be accessed via Google Books. Democracy, the God That Failed, starts out with a revisionist analysis of World War I. If only, Hoppe writes, the United States had not entered the war, the European monarchies would have been preserved. As mentioned earlier, Hoppe is an anarcho-fascist where the ideal system would be a confederation of small owned units As mentioned earlier, Hoppe is an anarcho-fascist where the ideal system would be a confederation of small, privately owned units controlled by natural elites, i.e. Heron mentioned. But until anarchy is possible, a monarchy is far superior to a democracy. What's Wrong with Democracy? Well, this is what Habermas's student, Hans Hermann Hoppe, a darling of the Austrian school and the Ludwig von Mises Institute, thinks. Democracy, Professor Hoppe tells his readers and presumably his students at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, is nothing more than mob rule and has resulted in a serious decline in civilization. Quote, the mass of people, as La Boetie and Mises recognized, always and everywhere consists of brutes, dullards, and fools, easily deluded and sunk into habitual submission. Thus, today, inundated from early childhood with government propaganda in public schools and educational institutions by legions of publicly certified intellectuals, most people mindlessly accept and repeat nonsense such as that democracy is self-rule and government is of and by and for the people. And then skipping down, even worse than the state capitalism of the United States is European social democracy and its myriad social programs. Universal health care, for example, is especially evil, according to Professor Hoppe. Again quoting, as a result of subsidizing the malingerers, the neurotics, the careless, the alcoholics, the drug addicts, the AIDS-infected, and the physically and mentally challenged through insurance regulation and compulsory health insurance, there will be more illness, more malingering, more neuroticism, more carelessness, more alcoholism, more drug addiction, more AIDS infection, and physical and mental retardation. That directly from Democracy, the God that failed. And then more commentary. Democracy, in this radical libertarian philosophy, or Democrats, excuse me, in this radical libertarian philosophy, are no better than communists, since Democrats rely on statist solutions that are antithetical to the natural order, unquote, and the cult of private property. And that, of course, I'm interjecting directly, that is precisely what Adolf Hitler was advocating in his speech before the Industry Club of Dusseldorf. It is also the philosophy of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and it is the philosophy of Peter Thiel. Brief break. How much time do I have left? I can see by the passage of time that some of the aspects of the deep fifth column will be gone into next week as well. But again, we're speaking on October 13th of the year 2013, and I cannot stress strongly enough that the elements that are literally rejecting and ransoming a democratic process itself in Washington, D.C., are part and parcel to the Palestinian libertarian milieu of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden. Snowden, the forces of which Snowden is a part, are part and parcel to what is going on in Washington. They are part and parcel to the secessionist elements that are rejecting democracy. We will talk more about that in weeks to come. Be sure to tune in next week, boys and girls, for another exciting episode of The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, but we're all out of time this week. Remember, Eddie's not like those other spooks, boys and girls. They're mean. Eddie is your friend. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 758, The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, Part 4, Dramatis Personae, Part 4, subtitled The Deep Fifth Column. This has been recorded on October 13th of the year 2013. My name's Jay Memory. Thanks for listening.